Turn your Bibles, 16th chapter of Luke, please. What kind of impression did you grow up or have you come to understand of God? Is He the personal close friend? Is He the righteous and stern God, the one that's willing to punish you whenever you make a mistake? Because you don't, then you aren't children. You know, you're chastised. Is He the personal God that's your buddy, willing to stand right there behind you, everything you're doing? Is He the indifferent God that looks down and only has the set of requirements you have to meet in order to satisfy Him, but your day-to-day problems aren't really His concern? Is He the benevolent God that sits up there just eager to answer every request that we have? Or is it an amalgamation of all of them? I've been taught all of these over my life. Different people try to present different aspects of God. No, none of them, of course, are absolutely correct. And there's a little bit of all of it to God's character. Well, can we really know God, though? Can we really understand, conceive of what He is or how He is? That's not a rhetorical question. Can we?
Yes.
And how?
In Jesus.
How? What is different about Christ that makes it more attainable to us, to our senses?
Well, it's all His compassion, it's all His perfection, and He dealt with all the issues that He faced as a man.
That's good. Anything else? All right. Christ is the man God. He is the human embodiment of God Himself, both God and man. And while we cannot perhaps comprehend the Spirit that speaks and creates things out of nothing, we can understand in the shape of a man who still has attributes of His heavenly creation. Certainly there was something different about Christ. Something had to be toned down. Something had to be knocked back. Something had to be a little bit hidden. Even the very appearance of Christ in His resurrected body, certainly, is terrifying, is awesome, is blinding. Knocked Paul off his mule and blinded him, I believe. John describes Him as a voice like many waters, thundering waterfalls. Christ wasn't preaching on Mount Olives like that. Now He blind and stun everybody instead of teach them. So there's something a little bit different about it. Now, same question. Why did Christ speak in parables so much? This is an easy one. Anybody can answer this. Why did Christ speak in parables so much?
Simple story, simple truth. We can understand it.
Good. Anybody else?
He brought it down where we all could understand it.
All right.
He also brought it to a point where only certain ones could understand it.
All stories have a point to them. Even if we were just telling for entertainment. I remember a certain person told a story of a wedding one time. He stood up and says, my brother was going up a long mountain road, had gravel on, and somebody come around the top of the bend, was coming down this long grade, and started hitting his brakes and started slithering, sliding, and bumping, and sliding. My brother said this, oh no, I'm going to die. And he kept sliding and sliding, the gravel and catch and slid and bounced in the ditch and back out. And my brother's thinking, oh no, I'm going to die. And come to a screeching halt right next to my brother's vehicle. Then he rolled out of the window, leaned out, and says, these brakes is handy things, ain't they? You know where I heard that story. That was at Daniel's wedding. There's a point to that story, though, isn't there? Every story I've ever heard, whether it be a fairy tale, whether it be an anecdote, my mother was constantly telling me about little boys that she knew that very bad things that happened to them. Yeah. The little boy's playing on a propane tank and it blew up. Didn't even find a piece of them. Little boy was out in the woods and got caught by some bad men, tied him to a tree and set him on fire. Little boy was up in a tree and fell out and broke all the bones on the right-hand side of his body. You know, for years I thought she has made that stuff up also. But come, she actually did know all these things. My favorite, what we used to do when I was probably about 8 or 9 years old, we'd go out my Uncle Wilbur's pig lot and we'd ride his pigs. I'm not a horse person at all. I'm going to tell you. I don't care for horses. They bite. You know, they buck you off. They kick. I'll take cow or horse every day, but pig will give you the best ride. Yeah, get about a 100-pound piglet and about an 80-pound boy, 60-pound boy, and jump on its back, grab its ears, and you go every which way but straight. They will run you backwards. They'll take you through the blackberries. They'll scrape you across the barbed wire. They'll do everything. And it's great. It's wonderful. Mom always told me a story about Mr. Pitts, who went out to these pigs one morning, didn't come back. His children went out next day and found out he was lying out there, and the pigs ate him. Ate him right up. Apparently, had a heart attack. I always figured she made that up. And she'd been passed on probably about 5 years. I got to talk to one of my older cousins, and I asked her about this. She says, no, that really happened. Yeah, it really did. All those stories had a point, didn't it? And there is such a vivid imagery, even now, 50 years later, I can pull those stories up and know exactly what was being expressed to me. Now, what parables have we just heard from Christ? The 100 sheep, remember that one? 15th chapter, 8th verse. Or what woman have 10 silver coins loses one coin? 11th verse. A certain man had two sons, the prodigal son. We actually did back when we used to do children's Christmas programs. Me and Miss Bichette used to do that. We did a prodigal daughter for Christmas one time because we didn't have any boys in the church that would memorize lines. I remember we had the Matt Christian girls up there, and one was a good daughter, one was a bad daughter. We had a lot of fun that time. How many times have you heard these parables taught in Sunday school and sermons? Preached on them, have even taught them yourselves to your children or your Sunday school class. I know myself, probably hundreds. Now we come to the 16th. He also said to the disciples, there was a certain rich man who had a steward, and an accusation was brought to him that this man was wasting his goods. So he called him and said to him, what is this I hear about you? Give an account of your stewardship, for you can no longer be steward. Then the steward said within himself, what shall I do? For my master has taken the stewardship away from me. I can't dig. I'm ashamed to beg. I've resolved what to do that when I'm put out of stewardship, they may receive me in their houses. So he called every one of his master's debtors to him and said to the first, how much do you have, my master? And he said, 100 measures of oil. So he said, take your bill and sit down quickly and write 50. Then he said another, how much do you owe? And he said, 100 measures of wheat. And he said to him, take your bill and write 80. So the master commended the unjust steward because he had dealt shrewdly, for the sons of this world more shrewd than generation the sons of light. I say to you, make friends of yourselves by unrighteous mammon, that when you fail, they may receive you into your everlasting home. But he who is faithful in what is least is faithful also in much, and he who is unjust in what is least is unjust also in much. How many times you heard this parable in Sunday school? How many times you taught this parable in Sunday school? Now, not the last two verses. I mean the whole parable. How many times you've seen a devotion based around this parable? I myself would say it's a zero. I read a lot. Why is that? Because this parable, of all of them, on the face of it, doesn't seem to make any sense. Here's this employee who gets caught with his hand in the cookie jar, stealing from his master. Then he steals even more from his master by cheating him out of his due, essentially bribing the people who owe him money. And then on top of it, his master commends him for his actions. And then Christ seems to approve of it also, on the face of it. I've read a lot of commentaries about this lately, by the way. And everybody tries to put a little bit of a Band-Aid on it. But before we go there, let's talk about why did Christ use parables? It was the style of teaching, not just Christ, but all the teachers, the rabbis, you know, the Pharisees. This was the style of teaching. If Christ was a math teacher, everything would be a word problem. If he was a history teacher, everything would be an acted out panorama. Since he was a spiritual teacher, everything was a parable. That's what they did. So it was an imagery that would stick in your mind and everybody could have a clear understanding of it. Not just then, but 2,000 years later. Now, familiar situations make more of an impression. Christ could have said, well, there are 651,000 of y'all, and one of you goes astray. My Heavenly Father wants to go search him out, redeem him, to spiritually renew him, and bring him back into the fold. That doesn't make the same impression on a person as sheep being lost. Because unlike us, they were very much in tune with the things you had to do to stay alive. They plucked their own chickens back then. How many of us had to pluck our supper lately? I know a lot of us have in the past. But our time in the last 100 years, well, I'll say 200 in the Western world, are so divorced from what it takes to actually stay alive that we actually have to remind ourselves some of these things in these parables that for 1900 years was extremely apparent to everybody because it was about the things that are everyday necessities for staying alive. You have to have some means of exchange, whether it be money or goods to trade. You have to have a house. You have to have possessions that you can use in order to get sustenance. You have to have fields. You have to have crops. You have to have cattle. All these things are necessary to life. And these are what were included in the parables of Christ. This is what was included in the stories that the rabbis taught. Times change, but the imagery still remains. Because even today, we can understand a son that wants to leave and live riotously and then return. We can understand another son who is jealous, who is angry, who feels they've been treated unjustly. We can sympathize with someone who has lost a good portion of their nest egg. You ever lost your car keys? Or today your phone? Thank goodness I have a ringer that I usually leave on. I lose my phone about 14 times a week. I'm always saying, call my phone. Let's see if we can find the thing. Now, Christ actually tells us also why he spoke in parable. It annoyed the disciples a little bit. Did you know that? All right, keep your finger there. Turn to Matthew chapter 13. Matthew chapter 13. Read the 10th verse there for me, please. Who's got it? Who's got it? Who's got it? John, Big John, 13:10.
Disciples came and said to him, why do you speak to them in parables?
Well, that verse, he answered. What is
to you it has been given to know the secrets of the kingdom of heaven, but to them it has not been given.
Read the 12th, please.
For to the one who has, more will be given, and he who will have an abundance. But from the one who has not, even what he has will be taken away.
13th verse, please, Greg.
Therefore I speak to them in parables, because while seeing, they do not see, and while hearing, they do not hear, nor do they understand.
Next, please.
And in their case, the prophecy of Isaiah is being fulfilled, which says, you will keep on bearing, but will not understand, and you will keep on seeing, but will not perceive.
For the hearts of this people have grown dull, their ears are hard of hearing, their eyes they have closed, lest they should see with their eyes and hear with their ears, lest they should understand their hearts and turn, so that I should heal them. In the 16th verse, over here, Pastor Russ, will you read that, please?
Blessed are your eyes, for they see, and your ears, for they hear.
17th also.
Truly I say to you, many prophets and righteous people long to see what you see and did not see it, and to hear what you hear and did not hear it.
And again, on the face of it, well, it sounds like Christ is saying, so I don't care about them. I don't want them to hear and understand. It's not important for them to hear and understand. On the face of it, that I've heard people say that. So, is that really the case, though? Do we know that to be the case? Did Christ not care? Did he not want these people to be saved? Somebody please say no. Thank you. Okay, no. He wanted them to be saved. But they were a product of their culture. A religion that devolved into a ritualistic, point-scoring technique of appeasing an indifferent God who had no effect, no real meaning in their life. A religion that was based on filling in the spaces and then doing what was right in your own eyes. They would not express it that way. But that was the world that Christ was ministering to. I mentioned before, you read Edersheim's sketches of Jewish life, the temple, all his works that he did. That's why I grew up reading. And it sounds like a very idyllic lifestyle. But we know from reading the accounts in the Gospels and in the New Testament that that was not the case. These people were very self-centered. They were very social conscious, positional conscious. Where they fit in the pecking order is very important to them. They clung to what they wanted for their own selves. And part of this was just survival. You know, if you've got $1,000, you can afford to lose one or two, maybe not look for it. But if you only got 10 and one's gone, you better find it. If you're hungry and your neighbor has a baby and you have a baby, well, sure, you want to boil and eat theirs first, then you'll hide yours. That really happened. That was the kind of culture that he was at. They were looking not for spiritual salvation. They were looking for military leadership. They were looking for an earthly king. That is what they were looking for. So Christ spoke to them in parables and did not explain always to them what they meant. He explained to the disciples sometimes. He got a little annoyed at them sometimes because they were kind of dull. He said, what, you don't understand this? I'll explain it to you. The people he's speaking to had already closed their minds. There's just no talking to a closed mind. You ever heard that? I was taught that while I was growing up. I was also taught you should always appreciate the other person's point of view. Even if you disagree with it, you should listen. If nothing else, then you know the correct way to argue against it. Yeah. My father taught me a lot of things. He said, always smile, son. You stick the knife in deeper if you do it. Yeah. I was also told, son, you're short, you're slow, and you're not too smart. Best learn to be polite. They didn't want religion that required real compassion. They didn't want religion that required morality or selflessness. That wasn't the way they operated at this time. That's not to say the Jewish religion did not require it, but their culture, their interpretation of the law, their traditions had been so overlaid on top of the Mosaic law, of the spirit law. And this was no new thing. In the minor prophets, you know, God has sent a prophet and says, look, I have no delight in your burnt sacrifices. You know, I don't care about the tithes and the burnt offerings. What I'm interested in is what comes out of your heart, your intent, your desires. You know, I reject your sacrifices. This is a recurring problem. Not just 2,000 years ago, but we see it today. How many times when you're growing up, going to church, those of you that went to church when you were young, you knew people that were very devout on Sunday, but on Saturday night or Monday afternoon or Thursday morning, there was no evidence of their faith in their language or the stories they told or the kind of entertainments they pursued. That's the exact same thing. Your religion that does not affect your behavior is not your religion. It's a pretense. It's not real unless it affects you. Now, here's the problem, this parable. Some of these things we do not understand because in our world, we interpret it the different way. As a matter of fact, at the top of the chapter, you probably have a little title that says the unwise servant, the thieving servant, the unjust servant. You see that? Okay. Let's break this down a little bit. Now, I'm going to be doing a little bit of conjecture here. And that's dangerous. So I want to be very clear. This is my conjecture from what I have studied and what I've researched. That's all it is. The position of steward was not like we would commonly think of as an employee. You might have someone you put in charge of doing all your rental properties. And you check up on them every now and then, okay? And if you get caught with catch them skimming, what do? You fire them right then. Mr. McKay might have an employee in charge of milking his cows. And he finds out half the cows are out there bellowing because they haven't been milked. What's he going to do? I know Mr. McKay, they'd have their stuff in a cardboard box at the road like 5 minutes later. That is the way we think of it, but that's not the position steward had. Steward was actually more like a chief executive officer of a corporation. It didn't matter what the owner said. What he said was what was going to count until he lost his position. We have to understand that. Herod had a steward named Chuzra, I believe. I'm probably butchering that. Chuzra or Chuzra, which one's right? Neither one? Okay. It's important because his wife, who, if I remember correctly, was Susanna, was one of the chief women that went around paying the bills for Christ and his disciples. And Herod had no say in this. A steward was in total control of what his master had put him in control of, to set contracts, to set deals, to hire, to fire, do whatever he thought was best. And his master kept his hands off. That was the true relationship here with a steward in the first century. Now, he was accused. It's interesting that phrase is, and an accusation was brought to him. This man was wasting his goods. It doesn't say the man was actually found to be wasting his goods. It doesn't say he was accused of it. Do you notice a subtle difference there? As in many cultures even today, the way to get ahead, the way to deal with an opponent, the way to do business, oftentimes, is to slander them, to make an accusation. Because it's just as effective as the real thing. Does anybody ever remember a movie called It's a Wonderful Life? It had Jimmy Stewart in it. You know, the angel comes down. What was the angel's name? I forgot. Anybody remember? Clarence. Clarence the angel, yeah. And says, okay, it'd be better if I'd never been born. Because here was something that he was about to ruin his life. He had done nothing wrong. Nothing wrong. But because of slander and scandal, he felt his life and his family was about to be totally ruined. He was going to lose his business. His reputation was all going to be gone on the basis of an unfounded rumor. And Japan, to this day, that is an extremely common business method to gain advantage, is to point the finger. There is no definite account here. He was actually guilty of this statement. To the contrary, he was not immediately removed from his position as steward. Do you appreciate that? Because you keep reading. He called and said to him, in the third verse, and the steward said with himself, what shall I do? My master has taken his stewardship away from me. He hasn't taken it already. He's going to take it. I can't dig. Probably he's an older man. And I'm ashamed to beg. In the fifth verse, so he called every one of his master's debtors. Now, probably these were tenant farmers. The true coin was not a universal medium of exchange in first century Palestine. A lot of items of barter. Because of the produce, this is probably an agreement that he had made with tenant farmers. We get so much of your product in payment for using land. That's why it was in, I'm not sure I tell it right, oil and wheat. One was probably an olive grove, the other was probably a wheat field. Now, he is in absolute control of the ability to make and renegotiate contracts. So he brings them in and he says, I'm gonna charge you a lesser amount. We don't know the context. It might have been a bad year. It might have been all they had. It might have been a very good year. The point is, he had the authority still under his master, even after being accused, to continue run his master's affairs. If he's not stewardship anymore, these contracts have no legality. They're not going to be upheld. He still is doing his job. He has not been fired yet. He renegotiates everything. Now the master hears about it and commends him. It may even say the unjust steward in your translation there. Why would he commend someone who had just cost him money, do you think? John.
I don't think it was necessarily a legitimate commendation. Of him really praising him in the genuine sense. It's more an acknowledgement that, oh, that rascal, he was pretty smart and really did a smart move there. More, I think it was more like that.
I think you hit the nail on the head right there, actually. He's acknowledging the shrewdness of his steward. He might not necessarily like it, but there's nothing he can do about it because his steward is still acting as his agent, his complete agent. For the sons of this world, more shrewd than the generation sons like. And here is where my best conjecture is. When Christ says, I say to you, make friends for yourselves by unrighteous mammon. And when you fail, may receive me. I think this is very much akin to, who was it? Skinnied up the tree, the sycamine tree? Zacchaeus. Christ comes along, looks up, says, come down quickly. You might understand the import of that. The sycamine tree in the fall. Putting a lot of water up the trunk. Trying to put on the foliage real quick. They're noted for being, this isn't a sycamore like we have around here. It's like a grease pole. When Christ says, come down quickly, he's making a joke. That's the only way you can come down. It's like a fire pole. I think this here is Christ using sarcasm. I say to you, make friends yourselves by unrighteous mammon. When they fail, it may receive an everlasting home. I think that's what we're reading right here. And translation just doesn't bring it through. Comments, disagreements, other viewpoints. Now it's time to tell us. Yes, John.
Maybe I'm not completely sure what you mean when you're saying you use it sarcasm, but what has really hit me over the years as I've pondered on this is that I think Jesus is comparing. He's saying, look, in the situation where somebody knows he has a limited time to have management over these resources, he's smart enough, even though he's doing it wrongly, to use those limited resources to benefit himself in the long run. And he says, and yet the people who ought to especially do that, Christians, who have a limited management of things on this earth, are not smart enough to use what they have now to benefit themselves for eternity. And he says, look, I mean, even an unsaved guy knows if he's got a limited amount of time to do something, he ought to do it now to benefit himself later. We ought especially to know whatever God has put in our hands is for a limited time. We ought to use that for eternity to make eternal friends and do eternal good.
Yes.
I think that's the nail right there. I think that's a very good description of it.
Okay. Jonathan's? Yeah. Yes, back there in the back.
There's a psychological aspect to this that we're all can identify with, and that's the fact that we know what is the right thing to do. And so we say, well, I'm going to do that, but if I don't do it right away, I will make excuses not to do it.
That's right.
And I think that idea of come quickly, let's do what you ought to do and do it now.
Yeah.
And my wife says that to me all the time. Keep in mind the culture. The people he is speaking to would have themselves seen put themselves in the position of the steward. They would have seen that also as being a very shrewd and very smart thing to do. Boy, he is sharp. They would have admired the unjust steward, even though they weren't supposed to, even though it's not what their religion was supposed to get from them. This would have been seen as a sharp business practice to be admired. And however you translate it, however you see that, he who is faithful in what is least is faithful also in much. He who is unjust in what is least is unjust also in much. That is a proverb of profound implication. It's very true. If someone will steal a penny, they'll steal a dollar. If someone will cheat checkers, they'll cheat on a relationship. If I was president of the United States, I would never hire anybody that had been unfaithful in a relationship. I can't expect somebody to keep a secret estate if they can't fulfill an oath. What Christ is saying here, he's giving an image of someone who has a position of trust and who uses it for his own gain. He may not have been guilty. He may have been unjustly accused. But he used it not to fulfill his employer's needs or his employer's obligations, but to feather his own nest. He was not doing what Christ would approve of. Christ is not approving of his behavior. He's doing what would be approved of by the world they lived in. He was not honest in much or little, or not faithful. I suppose that would be the better term. Christ dismisses the wisdom and the riches of this world. True or false? Christ dismisses the wisdom and the riches of this world. True or false?
That's false.
He does not dismiss it. Why is it important?
Because he's teaching a lesson. As he said right then, the people of this world are smarter than we are.
And the ways of this world, they are. I would agree with that. It says, make profit of yourself by, you know, mammon. What is mammon? Let's get it straight. That's not just money. That's objects that you use to enrich yourself in some way. It can be money, and oftentimes is. But it can be anything. It can be power or prestige. You do understand that. It can be position. But mostly it's talking about something of value that you can trade, that you can use to enhance your position. Yes?
I'm trying to think. Of course, Joseph was a steward.
Yes.
But it's a different, he handled it so differently.
Let's get a parallel. Joseph was Potiphar's steward. And when he was found, when he had a chance to enhance himself with Potiphar's wife, he ran away. Later, he was at one of Pharaoh's. I don't know if it's actually called him a steward for Pharaoh. I really can't speak to the Egyptian practice. But certainly he fulfilled obligation as steward, taking care of the granaries in Egypt. He did very well. I don't know what this guy's name was, but it probably wasn't Clarence.
The lesson that Joseph taught later was the government's going to end up with it anyway.
Anybody else? Jonathan, do you have your hand up?
Yeah, what really sticks out to me this morning, as I notice he refers to the wealth that's our money, because Christians, two times as unrighteous. I don't think he means that we've gotten it in an unrighteous way or that it's sinful, but I think in a sense, we think, oh, there's nothing spiritual about, you know, my finances or my money. But what he keeps pointing to is he's saying, listen, if you're not honoring me with your money, if you're not investing the physical things that you don't think are, you know, of spiritual consequence in spiritual things, he says, then how do you expect for me to give you eternal riches? And so what we're doing right now with our money or our possessions or these things that maybe we don't think, oh, that's not a big spiritual thing, what I do with my money or my finances or my whatever, God says, actually, that's critically important, because what you're doing with that is going to have a tremendous effect on all eternity, on how much God entrusts you with these great, he says, eternal or the true riches. And so that puts a big priority on what we do with our money right now, doesn't it?
How much of our money belongs to us and how much belongs to God as Christians? John.
I believe it all belongs to God.
Bingo. That's exactly right. How much of the money did the Jews understand belonged to them and belonged to God? This is a little trickier. 10%. Technically, if you follow the Mosaic law, let me see if we get it straight. You have 10%, plus you had temple tithe. We had this figured out one time when Bill researched this. What was it? 22% actually in total in every obligation they had. But and everything else is theirs. You see, we have a different view about money. And most of it has to do with the parables of Christ and teachings of Christ. That is the difference. And that's what Christ is doing. Keep in mind, what Christ is doing is not presenting a new religion. He's presenting a new relationship with God to these people who have pretty much ruined the previous arrangement. A lot of them were innocent. It's like the Japanese guy said, no, teacher teach, student do. They had been taught that this was proper. They had been told by their parents, by their teachers, by their employers, by our society, that the way they did things was correct. You go to the temple, you pay your tithe, you make your offering depending on, you know, your economic situation. Then you go and do what you got to do. Don't touch any Gentiles. That's important. You know, make no representation of an object that could be construed as an idol. So if the Romans came along with their eagle on the banner, they would riot. Thousands of Jews were slaughtered because of that. Because the Romans bring their eagle banners into Jerusalem. Did you know that? They lay down their lives for that. But if you saw a wounded man lying on the side of the road, your first concern wasn't to help him. Your first concern was, will I be unclean and unable to do my duties, things I want to do? Or is there trouble here? I was edged along the side. You see? You were supposed to amass wealth. It was a sign of blessing from God. If you had a son that wanted to take off half of your riches, you might let him go, but goodness gracious, he's not coming back home. You did what you're supposed to do. Likewise, your brother shows back up seeking forgiveness after doing what he did. You're not going to have anything to do with him. That's not just. And you're definitely not going to have milk and meat at the same meal, because you might accidentally boil the kid in the mother's milk. You are going to wash your hands in the proper prescribed way, and you are going to wash your utensils in the proper prescribed way. But you're not going to consider someone else's welfare that you don't know before yours. So when Christ says, the greatest commandment is love the Lord thy God with all mind, heart, and soul, and the second is like unto it, love thy neighbor as yourself. That's why lawyers say, well, who is my neighbor? Trying to weasel his way out of it. That's what these parables are doing to these people.